Welcome to the Two Mics on the Record. This is our podcast series, which has been going now for a good long time, probably more than a year, maybe two years, very nearly.
Yes.
Originally started up just to be a sort of a promotion, really, for our New York show.
That's right.
Which took place last September of 2017. We are, however, now getting close to Christmas.
Yep.
And, of course, the Christmas spirit is full and vimin-like out there.
That's it.
But we've got another couple of good podcasts to go before we get to Christmas.
So we certainly have.
How would you like a free case of craft beer? Well, as a listener to our show, we'd like to thank you for listening with the help of our friends at beer52.com. Just go to beer52.com/Mike, that's M-I-K-E, to claim your free case, the perfect chance to get some special beers in for Christmas.
Wowee! Beer 52, let me tell you folks, is the world's most popular monthly craft beer discovery club, searching out incredible, and I have to say exclusive, small batch craft beers from the world's greatest breweries and bringing them all back for their members. That's right.
That's right. Every month focuses on a new country or theme, and listeners who sign now will get to discover fantastic beers as part of their West Country Road Trip Month, featuring amazing beers from up-and-coming brewers in and around Bristol, such as Firebrand's Juicy New England IPA. If you like a darker beer, get yourself the mixed case. If you like a lighter beer, get the light case.
It's easy. Fabuloso. Now you'll be able to read all about the beers and learn more about how they are made in the 100-page Ferment magazine, which is included in the box.
And as a listener of our show, you can try your first case for free. Just pay £5.95 postage. That's 8 incredible craft beers, Ferment magazine, and a snack delivered next day shipping. It's a no-brainer.
It really is a no-brainer. And you're talking to people who have brains. Don't worry about that. There's no minimum commitment. You can just take the free case, try the beers, and see exactly what you think. You won't be disappointed. If it's not for you, you can pause, cancel any time. Don't miss this chance to get the beers in for the festive season.
Just visit www.beer52.com/Mike and claim your free case today.
That's right. Let me repeat that, please, for you. Just to tell you once again, it's beer52.com/Mike.
So what have you got for us, Paulie?
Well, I want to talk to you about getting sacked, OK?
Now, why? What are you going to sack me from the two mics?
No, I'm sacking the two mics. Yeah. You're not going to sack me.
I've been sacked many times, of course.
Yeah, well, exactly as I'm saying. Now, I'm now referring to a memoir from a chap called Sam Leith. Okay?
Memoir, yes.
And Sam Leith has been around for years. Mm. And in his memoir, he just starts by saying, I got the sack the other day from the London Evening Standard, where I've been a weekly columnist for about a decade. Somebody rang me up and said, belt tightening, old boy, OK?
Yes.
Now, of course, London Evening Standard is now edited by George Osborne.
Your mate George.
Yeah, I doubt if George Osborne knew anything about Sam Leith being sacked.
No.
Because I don't regard him as a hands-on editor.
Well, I don't know if you could be right in saying that, because Sam Leith was quite a high-profile columnist. And, I mean, normally, the one person who kind of takes interest in all the columnists is the editor. Because, I mean, I remember every paper I've ever worked for, I'm sure you're the same.
Yeah.
The columnists were a very important part of it all.
Of giving the message of the paper
Not only that, but also they were the ones that you always had to wine and dine at. The editor would have a columnist Christmas lunch and all of that.
Yes.
And, of course, they all hated each other.
Yes.
Because they didn't like the idea that somebody else had a column, and they had a column. They wanted to only be the only one.
It's absolutely right.
Mm.
Anyway, he goes on to say, as Fleet Street sinks giggling into the sea...
Yes.
It's quite a good expression, that, really, because he's talking about their circulation to newspapers and all that kind of stuff, you know. A mini tradition is emerging for long-serving hacks to grumble about losing their regular work.
Mm.
So, for instance, he points out that in recent months, people known to us, very high profile, Rachel Johnson, who happens to be the sister of Boris Johnson.
Indeed.
Part of that sort of political dynasty.
Yes.
She got the boot from the Mail on Sunday.
Yes.
And Lynn Barber got the boot from the Sunday Times.
Was it not the case that Rachel Johnson, before she got the boot, because she was part of the old guard at the Mail on Sunday, which is Geordie Gregg, his editor, he went over to the Daily Mail.
That's right.
Leaving Ted Verity to take over the Mail on Sunday.
That's right.
My understanding is that she was given a very, very nice renewed contract shortly before she was fired. So they had to give her a bucket load of money more than they would have done if she hadn't been given a new contract.
See, that's a disgraceful trick, isn't it?
So Geordie Gregg basically looked after
her
to make sure that she would be more expensive to sack.
Geordie Gregg probably already knew Ted Verity, you know, didn't fancy her.
No.
And
well, because the feud currently going on there is between the former editor, Paul Dacre, that everybody knows,
who's
been there
the chairman
years and years and years.
Yeah.
He's been moved upstairs.
That's right.
The belief is that he's kind of pulling the strings for the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah.
And the sort of the old crowd of the Daily Mail are now more likely to be working for the Mail on Sunday.
Yes, that's right.
You know.
But he's certainly not pulling strings on the Daily Mail because it's changed out of all recognition.
Unbelievable.
You know, its latest campaign is that we should all volunteer to be casual workers for the health service.
I thought you might join that campaign, actually, because obviously the NHS has been very good to you.
Yeah, yeah.
If it wasn't for the NHS, you'd be dead.
Yeah, that's true.
So you should go and volunteer.
Well, you know, I'm not against that. I might have a think about it. But anyway, the Rachel Johnson one's interesting because the minute she was out the door at the Mail on Sunday, I noticed she was cropping up many times in the Times.
Yes.
In the Times Saturday supplement and Times features.
Well, she's a very popular woman.
And by the way, somebody said to me the other night, who I was talking to, that Rachel Johnson's position has been taken by Tina Weaver.
Oh, is that right?
Tina Weaver, yeah.
Funnily enough, I saw Tina Weaver the other night.
Right.
I was out in a restaurant in Borough Market, funnily enough, and she came in with a crowd of people and couldn't get a table and had to leave.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
but I had my, I didn't, I was with somebody who recognised her, but I had my back to her, so I didn't see her.
No, okay, yeah.
But
so she's now, so she's a Geordie Gregg sort of acolyte, yeah?
Must
be.
Tina Weaver.
Tina Weaver.
No, I don't think so. She's in the Mail on Sunday.
Oh, sorry, Ted Verity acolyte. I beg your pardon. Yeah, she's taken Rachel Johnson's place, that's right. And, of course, it's very interesting, because Tina Weaver used to be the editor of the Sunday Mirror.
That's right.
Just to give everybody the Fleet Street political landscape.
Right.
And at the same time was romancing a man called Wallace, who's the editor of the Daily Mirror.
Richard Wallace, yeah,
Richard
they're still together.
They're still together?
Yeah, she's a lovely woman.
They've got a child, haven't they?
They have,
indeed.
And Richard Wallace now works with Simon Cowell over in California. Where he runs the America's Got Talent show.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
so it's all happening.
It's all circles within circles.
Indeed.
Now, the other one who went was Sunday Times' Lynn Barber.
Yes.
Now, when
I've never known Lynn Barber. She's got a very good reputation.
She's got a huge reputation.
And she's interviewed everybody that's anybody, right?
But, yeah, when I was on the Express Supremo News, right?
Yes.
The features editor there, who was, I think it was Heather, was always desperate to get Lynn Barber signed up, you know, and used to go to Nicholas and it would say, but she'd cost three times any other feature writer we've got. Because in those days, believe it or not, papers like the... Which one was it? She wrote for a Sunday paper, the Independent.
Did she not write for the Observer?
No, Independent. At some stage she did, but on this particular occasion, Independent on Sunday.
Right.
And she used to go and interview people and she started this... great method of actually not taking any notice of what they were saying, but repeating minutely their attitude to the interview, the way that they handled it, if they were respectable or unrespectful to her, or whether they were offhand and all that.
Right.
And then she'd pick up on little things they'd say, what shoes they were wearing, all that kind of stuff.
And did she not always have a very kind of... Who was the woman photographer who I'm thinking of that used to take all the pictures?
It wasn't Annie Leibovitz, was it?
No, I think there was a woman photographer, certainly when she was at the Observer, who used to do all the pictures.
Really?
Very much black and white, sort of portrait style stuff. You know?
I don't know. But anyway,
thanks anyway.
As Sam Leith writes in his memoir, you know, what comes round goes round, and he repeats a Kingly Amis riddle.
Yes.
When Kingly Amis was once sacked, because Kingly Amis, of course, great writer.
Is it Kingsley Amis?
It's Kingsley.
Yeah.
What did I say?
You said Kingly.
No, Kingsley.
Yeah.
And it reads like this. Life is mostly grief and labour.
Yeah.
Two things get you through. Chortling when it hits your neighbour, but whinging when it's you. Which
That's
is quite
good.
A good description of the
that
way it's going,
good.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, one of the funny things that is true about the world of journalism, and certainly the one that we knew, was that you got sacked quite a lot. I mean, I say to people always, sometimes much to their surprise, that, I mean, every time I got sacked, it was actually always a good thing.
Yeah.
I ended up doing something much more interesting, much better, after I got fired.
Quite the same with
And in
me,
fact,
really.
I was talking to a couple of people, I was at one of these parties, a sort of Christmassy-type party the other day, and I was talking to a couple of people who'd been fired from the Express many years after I was.
Yes.
And we were all sort of basically kind of commiserating with each other, but remembering that, thank goodness we're not still working there.
That's right.
And thank goodness we're now doing something which is a lot better.
That's right. I never picked up a load of money when I was sacked.
Did you not?
A lot of the time I turned it down, told them to F off.
Well,
when
you left the Express, you could have got money, couldn't you?
Could have got money, I decided I didn't want it.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Why would you? See, because some people have this thing about being fired, that they see it as some kind of personal affront.
Yes.
I see it as a badge of honour.
Yeah, well,
I mean, because I've never been
fired.
It was
a badge of honour, but I went to a better job and said, fuck you, money.
Yeah,
I don't need it. You know, I'm not taking
your
money.
Yeah, but that's because of your gross arrogance, though.
Well, it was, actually.
And
you're
at the end of the day, you don't wish to be indebted to anyone.
No,
right? Whereas me,
no.
I'll take any money you want.
Yeah, well, you see, that's because you're a slob, really.
No, it's not. No, listen.
Pick up the pieces.
No, I believe in compensation. If somebody wants to get rid of me, it's going to cost them money.
Yes.
And one of the things that... that I always made sure of was that if I was going to, I could always see it coming.
Yeah.
I always knew I was going to be fired.
Yeah, you kind of get a feeling.
At some point, you get an idea.
Yeah.
But I've never been fired for being crap at my job.
No.
I've only ever been fired for sort of political reasons.
I've never been fired for being crap at my job.
You sure?
I've always been fired for saying something out of turn.
Really?
And
that doesn't surprise me.
Telling somebody what a complete, absolute twat they were, and not to get in my way and all that.
No.
And then people going and complaining about me being, he's very aggressive. Well, you are very aggressive if people who are working with you and for you aren't very good at what they do.
Do you not think you're picking up the pieces? You fell victim to the sort of the world of the political correctness of,
I'm sure I did, yeah.
Of the 1990s.
Yeah, I'm sure I did.
When you were originally shifted off to America.
Yeah.
Not the first time, the second time.
Yeah, yeah.
Was as a result not only of your Benlin addiction, but also.
No, I don't have a Benlin addiction. It was.
Of the gross way that you used to talk to women?
No, I used to talk to women very, very respectfully.
Really?
I always have done in my life. But on one occasion, I said that one of the women I was working with was so hopeless at her job, I was finding it a strain and a pressure to work in a newspaper where, she was clearly so incompetent, you wouldn't do anything about
it. And who was that?
I'm not going to say.
No, okay.
Not going to say, but I'm kind.
She's still alive.
I did. Still alive,
yeah. Right.
But anyway, that brings us then to thoughts of revenge, says Sam, traditionally to turn up in these changes. So he says, who can forget the man who contrived to hide a packet of fish fingers behind a panel in his former editor's bathroom?
Yes.
And I mean,
that
is an amazing story.
That is an amazing story.
It's an amazing story. Now, we know that the editor in question was Rosie Boycott.
The very woman who fired me from The Express.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for not being a woman. I mean, that was the reason I got fired there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because apparently, when I went to see my Lord Clive Hollick after he'd bought the paper, he did one of these, very sort of New Labour-y type things. He decided to have a load of meetings with a load of the heads of department.
Right.
And I was at the time the night editor,
right?
So we all had to traipse upstairs to, his eyrie at the top of the building in Blackfriars Road.
Yes.
And Sir Clive sat there, and there was me and the sort of my two deputies, a couple of the chief subs, something like that.
And was the editor there?
I think he was, yeah.
Who was the editor?
It was Richard Addis at the time. Anyway, so Hollick turns to me and says, of all of the teams that I've seen today, yours is the only one that doesn't appear to have a woman in it.
Yeah.
He said, why is that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, it's nothing to do with me. I said, I have taken over this department, which has been run for several years very successfully by other people.
Yeah.
I said, it tends to be that many women journalists...
How long have you been doing it? How long have you been doing it?
Oh, probably 6 months or something.
Right, okay.
But I said, that there tends to be fewer women working in the production side of newspapers because they prefer to be news reporters or they prefer to be writers.
Or they don't want to work till 2 a.m.
And they don't want to work late at night. You know, I said all of that.
Yeah.
But I could tell that there was clearly something afoot.
Yes.
And sure enough, when I was fired, they replaced me with a woman.
Who was it?
Tina Moran. Who was, at the time, she was the production editor of the magazine.
No,
so she didn't have a fucking clue how to run the back bench of a newspaper.
No, exactly, Anyway, to explain, now, are we going to name the person who was the fish finger man?
We can, I think, because I think it's pretty well known.
Yeah, who is it?
His name is James Hughes Onslow.
James Hugh Onslow, that's right, Hugh Onslow, Hugh Onslow,
who was famously... I probably shouldn't tell you this bit. No, I won't tell you that bit.
No.
But he was famous for one or two other things. But he was very unhappy about being fired by Rosie Boycott.
That's right.
She was at the time living in a rather nice house in Notting Hill.
Was it Notting Hill? Or it was Dulwich.
No, it was Notting Hill. And her husband, new husband, was a barrister, I think.
That's right, he was, yeah.
And she had loads of money.
Yeah.
And she was putting the house up for sale.
That's right.
Because she was selling out and moving to the country or something like that.
That's right, yeah.
And he decided... in his wisdom. I don't know where he came up with this idea.
I think he's very clever.
Very clever.
I mean, and how did he manage to do it? They must have left him alone in the house for
Well, what he did
minutes.
Was he posed as a prospective buyer.
Yeah.
And, of course, she wouldn't have been there showing the house. So she would have been at work. So when he went round there, he went round with an estate agent.
The estate agent, yeah.
And so clearly the estate agent would have left him alone, because they normally do, don't they?
Yeah, they just one around.
I think it's quite a big house. So,
You
know, they're not going to follow you around.
No, no.
Unless... there's lots of valuables or something.
Yes, that's
so,
right, yeah.
So, yeah, I believe went into one of the bathrooms.
That's right.
pulled the panel of the bath out.
That's right.
Which you can do pretty quickly.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
If you know what you do.
Yeah.
And stuck a bunch of fish fingers in there.
That's right.
And just shut it up again.
Shut it up again, that's right, yeah.
And then after a while, of course, there was this horrendous stink in the house.
I thought they were kippers, but they definitely...
No, they were fish fingers.
Definitely fish fingers. Yeah, yeah.
And they couldn't work out where the smell was coming from.
Yes.
They literally dug up all the drains.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, incredible amount of money.
They took the floorboards up. Took the shower apart.
Yeah.
All sorts of things.
They took everything apart in the house that they could.
That's right.
And eventually, they discovered that it was all behind the bath.
That's right, yeah.
Which is amazing, really.
I know. I mean, could he not have been prosecuted for that then?
Well, I think he probably could have been had they known it was him.
Yeah, I see. And maybe, well, how do we know it's him then?
Well, I know it's him.
Let's just say that we know. Yeah.
I don't know how I know.
Yeah.
But I think there are plenty of other people that know as well.
Mm, okay.
You know.
Anyway, Sam Leith says in his memorandum, he says, I'm not like people who've done these sort of things. He said, I'm a pacifist sort of person, quite capable of letting geese pass without saying boo to them.
Uh-huh.
And besides, that doesn't seem much point openly plotting the downfall of the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, who, of course, is George Osborne, when there are so many others in the same game. He said, anyway, it backfired on me last time.
Mm.
My last great enemy ended up as the editor of another national newspaper.
Oh, really?
And he's talking about Tony Gallagher.
Oh, okay.
He says he was at the Telegraph.
Who's now editor of the Sun?
He's at now editor of the Sun.
Yeah.
He was at the Telegraph. He said, wasn't quite the nemesis I had in mind. I shall wish George Osborne well in his future endeavours and hope that things work out for him, which is very nice.
Mm.
He talks of another form of vengeance, and that is when you get, you know, dumped by your paper, just do something so remarkable that they will regret forever that they've lost you and never speak to them again when you become big and famous.
Right.
And he's talking about a guy called Lee Child.
Oh, yeah.
So he says, speaking of vengeance, the thriller writer Lee Child made a whole second career out of it. He was so fed up when he got sacked by Granada Television in the 1990s, excuse me, that's when they were sort of getting rid of people in Manchester, where Coronation Street was made.
Yes.
He went out and got incredibly intoxicated, apparently.
As you do.
Yeah, and invented a character called Jack Reacher.
Oh, yeah.
A man who now wanders around America knocking seven bells out of anybody who annoys him.
Well, played by Tom Cruise.
Played by Tom Cruise. Yeah. Lee has sold 100 million books and taken the film rights.
Wow.
So he must have struck a bit a chord.
Yeah? Was he just like a sort of jobbing writer or something on Granada TV?
No. Script writer or something. Yeah.
Do you remember the other story about Stephen Pollard?
Who was Pollard?
He was the guy who
Desmond.
He was the leader writer of the Express.
Yes.
And he got laid off. And he's now, I believe, the editor of the Jewish Chronicle.
He is indeed. But he writes lots of stuff as well in things like the Daily Express.
He's a good guy, actually.
Very good guy. Spectator magazine, all
but
that
he
kind
did
of
that
stuff.
Thing, which is quite, I suppose, obvious, really, rather than subtle.
Yes.
In which he wrote the leader, which is the opinion piece in the paper.
Yes.
And he started each paragraph with a letter.
No, it was each line, Mike. On the left-hand side.
Each paragraph?
No, on the left-hand side, because think how thin a leader column
is,
right? Yeah,
no, but it had to be a paragraph, though, because you can't do it. You can't work it out how it's going to turn.
I think he did.
No, you can't.
I think he stood over the bloke on the stone and said, you know, this is how I want it.
No,
seriously.
No, definitely.
Because they all hated Desmond.
Yeah, no, he did. And he spelled out anyway, one way or another, fuck you, Desmond.
That's right,
And of course, Desmond spotted it.
That's right, yeah.
And I don't know whether he fired him then without any money, but it got worse for him anyway. It wasn't a very good idea.
Well, also, he was leaving to go to another paper, I think it was The Times, as a lead writer, and they cancelled his contract.
I can give you one quick story of my revenge.
I would like that.
Which was on the Daily Express, because there was a woman managing editor.
Yes.
And when I got fired from there, I was making pretty good money and I had a pretty good job. I was number four on the paper at that point.
Yeah.
It was a Friday night, I remember, and I was producing the paper, and, you know, it's Friday nights, so the early off-stone time and all that. And I got a phone call on the back bench, which I very rarely got.
Yeah.
And it was this woman, whose name escapes me, funnily enough. Lindsay somebody. Yeah. She was the managing editor.
Right.
And she called me into her office. I said, well, I'm a bit busy at the
moment. Where was her office?
It was up near where yours used to be, in that little enclave.
So it's on the same floor?
On the same floor, up at the end of, the river end,
right? Yeah.
But it didn't have any windows. It was one of those extra ones they built. Tiny little cubbyhole.
Yeah.
And she calls me up and she sat me down. She said, well, here's the thing, Mike. You know, Rosie's had a look round and she's making a few changes. And she said, I'm afraid that there isn't a role for you.
Yeah.
And I went, I beg your pardon? What do you mean it's not a role for me?
Yeah. She said, well, in the middle of getting the first edition out.
I said, apart from the fact that I've been a news reporter, I've been foreign editor, I've been features editor, I'm now the night editor.
Foreign correspondent.
I've been a foreign correspondent.
Run an international news, business in
so
New
I
York.
I said, you can't find me a job in the newspaper. Is that right? She said, yes, I'm afraid so. I said, well, you better not fucking be trying to get rid of me for no money. I said, I'm not leaving here until you tell me precisely how much money you're giving me.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, we can discuss all that next week. I said, no, no, no.
No, go on.
No, we can't discuss it next week. I need a piece of paper in writing from you right now to tell me precisely how much you're going to give me.
Yeah.
And I said, do you want me to leave now? And she said, yes.
Mm.
So I waited in her office, and she came back, gave me the piece of paper with a number on it, and I said, okay, that's fine.
Yeah. Was it fine?
It was okay. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't massive, but it was about 60
grand.
So
she'd gone round the corner and seen Rosie and said, I presume so.
So it was about 60 grand, something like
bad.
That, which
that's
was all right.
Because
the problem was, they'd done it in such a way that the most you could get in those days for unfair dismissal, which it undoubtedly was 50 grand.
Right.
They doubled it some years later, right?
Right, yeah.
But it was too early for that. Anyway, about 2 years later, it turned out that she had moved from the Express back to the Daily Mail,
right,
where she had come from originally. But it turned out there was something that I knew about her that nobody else knew. And I can't remember exactly what it was.
Right.
But I tipped off a mate of mine at the Daily Mail that this woman had done whatever it was that she had done.
Yeah.
And I said, you've got to time this perfectly, right? So let her hand in her notice and then fuck her over and don't give her the job.
That's really not very nice,
is
it?
So that's what we did.
Yeah.
So she left the Express and instead of going to join the Daily Mail, she didn't have a job because they were like,
We
changed her mind.
She might have signed a contract by then, so you might have given her money because she might have had to have had her contract paid.
She didn't have a job anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, loads of people have been fired at Fleet Street.
Oh, yeah, of course they have. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you another story. Yeah. And my mate Johnny Jinks, right? Mm. Great guy. Bit over the top now, old Johnny, you know, and
is he still alive?
I don't know. Because
what do you mean, don't know?
I don't keep in a lot of touch with him these days.
It's Christmas, right? Do you not like send people Christmas cards?
Not really. They've sort of gone out of fashion. Anyway, as far as I know, he's gone a bit gaga. So
that's nice.
Yeah.
Why don't you go and visit the guy?
Well,
is he in a home or something?
I think he's in the the journalist's home down in Dorking.
Really?
You know, for the old and the knackered.
Well, it's just down the road from you.
Yeah, well, it is, I suppose. But you know,
I go to the journalist's charity ball.
Yes,
which is the one that keeps those kind of people alive.
Well, I give lots of money.
Do you?
Yeah.
How much money did you give them this year?
About 150 quid.
150 quid?
Yeah, I'm a member of
the... Well, that's not going to keep him in Ravino for long,
What's it called, the journalist charity? I've forgotten.
Eh?
What's it called?
I can't remember.
Well, you said that you do loads of work for it.
No, I said I went to the ball.
Yeah, what's the ball called then?
I don't know.
Journalists, it's the...
Isn't it the NUJ thing?
It is the NUJ, charitable thing, and all that.
I don't think it's got
Chris
a name.
Chris Boffey was the chairman.
I don't think it's got a name. No, Robert Jobson's the chairman now.
Robert Jobson's the chairman, okay. We need to go to the ball then, because Rob's a good guy, and we promoted his royal book, didn't we?
Indeed, we did.
Yeah. Anyway, so old Johnny, who was indolent, by the way, idle. I mean, he stumbled into the job.
He became news editor of the Times, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it was all, you know, on the gravy train, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. For instance,
he must have been quite good at the job to be news editor of the Times.
He was always too laid back for me, because when I was a reporter...
Well, everybody's laid back to you.
Yeah, well, that's right. When I was a reporter at The Express, John was the news editor. And I always felt he was a bit laid back. But the thing is, John was a massive shagger and a massive drinker.
Yes.
So what he'd do is, he'd stumble in at sort of 9:45 in the morning.
Right.
And there was a man there called Mike Steamson,
whose
previous job before becoming a journalist in England was a member of the New Zealand Navy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for some bizarre reason. Oh, yeah. And he used to say things like, stand by, stand by. You know, he was always saying, stand by, stand by.
For what?
I don't know. But his name was Steamson. Stand by, stand by.
Stand by Steamson.
And so Johnny Jinks didn't do any work. He made Steamson do it all. So, you know, morning conference is at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
So John would come in about 10, a bit like a sort of Alan Brazil type arrangement, you know, when you're starting at 10.
Right.
And morning conference started at 10. But Al could come in at 1 minute to 10 and just get on with his job.
Yeah.
Johnny was always too hungover and been too much shagging
the
night
before. So he sent Steamson in?
No, he would make sure Steamson had a running news list for him to take in. But he didn't know anything about any of the stories.
Well, that's what every news editor does.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I mean, you know, you did that.
No,
didn't
I used to get there 7:30 in the morning, and on my news list was always bouncing.
Working too hard.
No.
I mean, you didn't go out for lunch. You did. You went out for lunch when you were a news editor.
Very rarely.
Really?
Used to go out with Walker sometimes. Have a couple of bottles. Most of the time, I sent Walker out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got on with it, and Walker would come back, run through the news file, and tell me the top six stories. Yeah. He was very good at spotting it.
Right.
But anyway,
because when he and I were there, and I was foreign editor, and he was news editor, when you were in America.
Yeah.
We used to go to the pub for sometimes three bottles, right?
Yeah, right.
Which was never a great idea. It was always a bad idea to have a third bottle.
Yeah, sure.
But he'd always be on the phone to somebody saying, right, prepare the news list, right? And he was the master at busking the stories.
That's right, yeah.
And the two of us, and the Duke as well, you know, Tukanovich,
we
were completely pissed, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And we'd be talking about these stories, doing fucking nothing about.
No, exactly, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it didn't matter, because your editor was Nick Lloyd.
Yeah, and he didn't care anyway.
Nick couldn't give a fuck.
Remember there was a story about some kid who sliced off the top of his finger.
Right, yeah.
And somehow had it reattached.
Yeah.
And the Duke went into paroxysms of laughter because Walker was explaining what happened without actually knowing what had happened.
No, that's right.
And he said, oh, yeah, Nick said something like, well, what happened to his finger?
Mm.
And he said, oh, yeah, he was trying to slice some cucumbers.
Yes, that's right.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, that's interesting.
Mm.
What was he doing that for? Mm. Well, he was making a cucumber sandwich.
Mm.
And this story got more and more elaborate.
That's right,
but it was all crap.
No,
it was all fucking rubbish.
It probably,
the kid had fucking had his it turned out, his thumb knocked off by a fucking circular saw or something
like that. Yeah, terrible. But anyway, and then so Johnny would come out of conference at about, you know, sort of 10:30, 11:20, spend 20 minutes, you know, issuing more instructions to Stevenson. I mean, literally kicking his arse, you know. You know, that story, you know, they don't like that, they like that, they like that, get moving on that and all that. And then we had a bunch of deadbeats on the news desk. One of them was called Cascinella, who was the world's
isn't
biggest...
Isn't he the guy that turned out to be the fantasist?
Yeah, complete
the place
fantasist.
In Spain.
Complete fantasist.
The place in Spain that didn't exist.
Yeah. complete fantasist. And he was the so-called copy taster.
I mean, how did any of these people survive?
I don't know.
How did they all get fired?
But the other guy, Jim, you know, I didn't like
Jim
you
Watson.
Then, and I don't like you now. They were the two copy tasters.
He was the guy. Yeah. Well, he got. Was it you that told me that? Yeah. Did you not get him shifted over to the picture desk?
Yeah,
because he was the one that every night.
That's right.
Again, we'd fall about laughing because we were so pissed.
And the address is C-A-V.
I said C.
A.
No, A.
A.
It was absolutely hilarious.
But. So Cascinella would go out first at 11 o'clock because they opened the Popinjay downstairs, followed rapidly by Jim Watson. So by 12 o'clock, right, it was the news editor's turn to go out because they all went out. Like, it was the reason there were so many people on the news desk was so that they could have a drinking rota throughout the day. So John would
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. So John would go about 12, having done like an hour and 10 minutes work, okay?
Yeah.
You all right there?
I'll just throw water over myself.
Yeah, no, just
I'm quite sure how I manage that.
Don't throw any electrical equipment,
will
you?
I'll try not to, no.
Short circuit me. And John would go out at 12. He'd come back about 3:30 or 3:40 and go through the same routine with Stevenson. Where's the night news list? Because the evening conference was 4 o'clock.
Right.
He still wouldn't know fuck all square about anything on the news list.
So what had he done all day then?
Well,
Not read anything?
No, what he used to do is, right, he used to go to the Popinjay and try and tap up a secretary, you know, or two.
Right.
He was always doing that.
Yeah.
And with some success, I have to say, you know. Mm. Then he would eat at lunchtime, which I couldn't do. They'd go across the road to a little Italian restaurant right across the road from the Old Express building.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think you worked in, did you, the Old Express building?
I never
building?
Did, no, but I mean, I remember that. I think I remember the Italian restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. And then you'd think, so that would take him to about sort of, you know, 2 o'clock. Then you think, well, he can go back to work. No, he wouldn't. He would then go up to Elvino's, where Ken Donlan, who was the news editor of The Sun, always came out late because they had very early off-stone editions of The Sun in those days.
Right.
You remember?
Yeah,
they were coming from Scotland or somewhere, their printing plant. They weren't printed in Fleet Street anymore. So they had very early off-stone editions. So Ken had to go out very late. You know, like at 2 o'clock to make sure the paper was together.
Right.
And Ken would then go back about 3:30 and check that the first edition was together, you know.
Right.
So John would go...
Also, they were quite small papers in those days as well.
Quite small.
It wasn't like they are now, where you'd have literally sort of 30-page leads to
find. That's right. No.
I mean, in those days, you'd only need about 15.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was your lot.
Yeah, 15 or 16. You know? So John would then go and see Ken. Hi, Ken. Buy him a couple of lodge gin tonic. Ken would tell him everything that was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, the sense of competition, you know, about, oh, I'm not telling you, that didn't exist in those days.
Right.
It was, you know, we look after each other. He'd then come back about 24. So anyway, the point I'm making, why did I start talking about John? I can't remember. Oh, yeah, when he got sacked.
Right.
He actually decided to take the dosh because his old mate, Nick Lloyd, and they'd shared a flat together in Chelsea when they both worked on the Daily Mail.
Oh, right. So they'd known each other of old?
Oh, known each other of old. Nick came out of Oxford University. His first job was education correspondent for the Sunday Times. Again, in Chelsea, they shared a flat together and they had a lot of birds down the old King's Road in the 70s. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. All that kind of stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
I can imagine, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was fun time. Mm. Nick even had a TR6 sports car.
Oh, really?
A red one, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, so when Nick came in, John decided he'd had enough. He'd done it for 4 or 5 years, you know. I mean, on the basis I'm telling you, hardly wears you out, that sort of work, does it? You know?
Well, not if you're not doing it the way
you're drinking and the shagging. Yeah.
Well, the drinking and the shagging is quite tiring.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So when he came in, he said to look, he said, I've had enough. He said, I can get another job with Charlie over at the Times.
Yeah.
Charlie Wilson had become the editor of the Times.
Right. Gorbals used
and
to
Charlie
be known,
was
he?
Another member of the pack who lived in King's Road with them from the Mail.
Yeah.
So this, you know, this gravy train's going round.
Yeah, yeah.
So Nick said, all right, John. He said, yeah, well, you know, Charlie's a good lad and all that. What job? He said, well, I'm starting off as night editor, but their news editor's fucking useless.
Right.
And Charlie says, I'll have the new test job within 6 months, you know. Okay, fine. So could you write me a letter for, you know, he said, yeah, okay. And because they're mates, Nick gave him a letter saying he'd have 3 years' money. I mean, which was just amazing.
What, he actually got that?
Well, I was just about to tell you. So so the salary, I remember distinctly, was £33,500 a year, right? And I know that because within a year I had John's job. I was appointed first as deputy, because I was very ambitious.
Yeah.
But Philippa was made news editor. Mm. She just didn't want to do it. I mean, she just couldn't do the hours and all that.
Right.
So she moved aside, and I took the news editor's job.
Right.
And I got £36,500.
Right.
And I talked to John about how much he got when he got it.
What year was that?
I was appointed news editor in 1980.
T5. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's not a bad amount of money in those days.
That was very good indeed. Mm. But anyway, the point of the story is, John had already spent about half of his Duncy money. He bought an Audi Quattro, you know. He decided to put money down. He was divorcing his wife, and that's why he needed the money.
Right.
His wife had, you know, always known about all his incessant shagging. I mean, really incessant. And John had met a young girl, you know. This is quite a tragic story. He met this young girl. And he was determined, you know, to make a new life for himself and all that. So when he bought a house in East Molesey, he bought an Audi Quattro.
Yeah.
But in between time, when his wife had thrown him out of the house, he actually contacted me and said, is there any chance of, you know, me staying with you for a few days? I have nowhere to live. And that was put forward by Jack Crossley, who was another malingerer, you know.
He was another kind of veteran malingerer, wasn't he?
So
I mean, when I first came back from America, where I'd been a very kind of self-starting, opinionated, kind of busy guy.
Yeah, but getting up every day and having to earn your own money.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it when I first came back to work at the Express. I mean, those fucking people who don't do anything.
Exactly. Nobody does anything.
Not only do they not do anything, they actually want to do anything.
That's right. But anyway, so John's, you know, in clover, he loves it all. Went out and bought a load of new suits from Savile Row, literally, you know.
Of course.
And then he went in to collect his money, from the dreaded Struan Cooper.
Ah, yes.
And Struan was the managing editor.
Yeah.
And Struan, talk about a poacher turned gamekeeper. Mm. Struan had been the NUJ representative on the floor.
Yeah.
Who negotiated with the company and struck some really hard deals. So the company did what is sensible to do, and you've got a hard union negotiator.
Yes.
You make him managing editor of the paper, and then he's dealing with the next union representative and crushing him, you know what I mean, and all that kind of stuff.
Fuck, you know.
So John goes in to see Struan, and Struan says, yeah, all right, John, well, you know, been good working with you and all that. They'd kind of grown up together on the Express, you know. And Struan said, just sign here, and then we can, so John... bit of paper put in front of John, and it says £67,000, you see.
Right.
And John said, hey, what the fuck is this?
And he thought he was getting 99.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Struan said, well, that's your settlement, 2 years' money. It's very generous.
It is very generous.
Yeah, very generous, yeah. Mm. And he said, you fuck off. He says, I've worked in it. He said, I'm getting 3 years' money.
Yeah.
And he spent half of it already, you know.
Right.
And Struan said, no, I'm afraid you're not. He said, you bastard, you know, went across the desk, you know, to grab him by the throat, try and strangle him. All this, you know. And he said, get off me, called security and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
And
his only drink had been taken at this point.
Oh, yeah, of course it has. He was down at the Savoy, you know, drinking champagne and all this. He'd done the deal of the century.
Right.
And And anyway, you know, the new owners who'd appointed Nick, you know, the guy from Yorkshire,
Lord Stevens.
Lord Stevens, yeah. had said, under no circumstance have we given this man
Nobody
3 years
gets
money.
3 years money.
Exactly, but Nick had, you know, promised it to. So obviously, John came, you know, he hated Struan Cooper for the rest of his life,
right.
you know, had a grudge against Nick for promising him the money that he never got right. and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, God.
But then went off and worked for Charlie.
But then got a decent job at the Times. So probably didn't make as much as that, but then,
yeah.
you know.
No, he didn't. You're absolutely right. You know, for a night editor at the time, wasn't yeah. it as much as the editor of the Daily
no.
Express? But, no, and then sadly, another mate of John's, who worked in the sports department, uh-huh. who I won't name,
right.
then ran off with the bird that he was leaving
oh,
home
God.
For to set up a new life with.
Oh, blimey.
So it didn't work out for him.
So it didn't work out. Well, it's good that you're still in touch with him, though. So you
yeah,
should try
yeah,
and
yeah.
look him up and make sure he's
well,
all right.
Well, I'm really not that in touch with him. I mean, once again...
No, I was being facetious.
No, I see what you mean. Yeah, once
yeah.
again...
You basically abandoned him.
I sort of resent. I kind of resent people who take advantage of me, and
uh-huh.
he went off and lived in Spain eventually.
Right.
What happened was he just ran out of jobs. You know, Charlie
yeah.
Wilson got sacked right. as head of the Times. John was out the next day. Then he sort of bummed around a bit at the Racing Post that was in those
yep.
days, news at the Racing Post,
yeah.
and then that closed and all that. So in the end, what he did was he sold up everything he had here, which was like the house in East Molesey, you know, which he just about kept going.
Yeah.
And he went to Spain with probably about £200,000, but bought a villa with a swimming pool for £20,000
nice.
In those days. And he loved the sun. He didn't care about being a lazy bastard all day. Didn't
no.
worry him that he had damn any work to do.
Yeah.
He loved that.
Right.
He would lie in the sun all day, you know, drinking a few sangrias and all that kind of stuff. He was happy. But every
yeah.
time he came back to London, I took him to the races at
yeah.
Epsom
right.
or Lingfield
yes.
and got a table in the restaurant
yeah.
and we drank and wined. And after about 2 years of this, I thought, he's never fucking bought me a drink
yeah.
at a race course
right.
for the last two or three
he
years when I've been
it.
Looking after him.
Yeah.
So the next time he came home, I don't know why, I got militant,
yeah.
and I said, yeah, what do you want? Oh, what's wrong, Michael? I said, nothing's wrong. I said, what do you want to do? Want to go to the races? Yes, sir. I said, well, you're paying. You're paying for everything. Do you
yeah.
understand me?
Yeah.
I said, including a car. I want a car to take me from here. I don't know why. I
yeah.
just suddenly got terribly resentful.
Suddenly flipped.
And we never spoke to each other again.
Oh, dear.
That's the way things are.
That's on the record.
I never picked up a load of money when I was sacked.
Did you not?
A lot of the time I turned it down, told them to F off.
Well,
want
you,
your,
when you left the Express,
yeah.
You could have got money, couldn't you?
Could have got money, yeah. I decided I didn't want it.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Why would you see? Because some people
yeah.
have this thing about being fired
yeah.
that they see it as some kind of personal affront.
Yes.
I see it as a badge of honour.
Yeah, well,
I mean, because
yeah.
I've never been
fired.
It was
a badge of honour, but I went to a better job and said, fuck your money,
yeah.
I don't need it, you know, I'm not taking
yeah, but
your
that's
money.
Because of your gross arrogance, though.
Well, it
you
was
know.
Actually.
I mean, at the end of the day, you don't wish to be indebted to anyone. Whereas me, I'll take any money you want.
Yeah, well, you see, that's because you're, you know, you're a slob, really.
No, it's not. No, listen,
pick up the pieces.
No,
yeah.
I believe in compensation. If somebody
yeah.
wants to get rid of me, it's going to cost them money.
Yes.
And one of the things that that I always made sure of
yes.
Was that if I was going to, I could always see it coming.
Yeah.
I always knew I was going to be fired.
Yeah, you kind of get a feeling,
at some point,
don't you
get
yeah.
an idea.
Yeah.
But I've never been fired for being crap at my job.
No.
I've only ever been fired for sort of political reasons.
I've never been fired for being crap at my job.
You sure?
I've always been fired for saying something out of turn.
Really?
And
that
telling,
doesn't surprise me.
Telling somebody what a complete, you know, absolute twat they were, you know, and not to get in my way and all that.
No.
And then people going and complaining about me being, you're very aggressive. Well, you are very aggressive if people who are working with you and for you aren't very good at what
yeah.
they do. And he said, you fuck off. He says, I've worked in it. He says, I'll get 3 years' money.
Yeah.
And he spent it off
yeah.
already, you know.
Right.
And Stuart said, no, I'm afraid you're not. He said, you bastard, you know, went across the desk,
right.
you know, to grab him by the throat,
right.
try and strangle him. Yeah. All this, you know. And he said, get off me, call security,
right.
and all this kind of
right.
stuff, you know.
Right. You've got to time this perfectly, right? So let her hand in her notice and then fuck her over
yeah.
and don't give her the job.